All right. Good morning. We're thankful to be here with you this week. Looking forward to it. Also trembling a little bit. That's good for us, isn't it? I was thinking, just sitting here, of just a couple-minute meditation, a spiritual meditation. I can't think this morning. I read it recently. Which chapter is the account with the 10 lepers? Is that, can someone help me with that? One of the Gospels here, Matthew. I was looking at it just recently. I didn't write this down. Does someone have it? 10 lepers. Jesus healed the 9. Or he healed the 10, sorry. Let's look at the one in Luke 17. Luke 17. All right, thank you. Yes, that's the one I wanted. Just an interesting little observation here in this passage. Verse 17 says, after this one returned, it says he was a Samaritan. And Jesus answering said, were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? There are not found that return to give glory to God save this stranger. And he said unto them, arise, go thy way, thy faith hath made thee whole. In verse 17, it says cleansed. Cleansed, and that's a different Greek word than when it says, your faith hath made you whole. And the word there, verse 19, hath made thee whole, that's the same Greek word that's used speaking many times when someone was, their sins were forgiven, or It's the same word as soteria. In the Greek, it's for salvation. It's the Greek word for salvation. That just blessed me. The one returned and gave thanks, and he was made whole. He got more of a blessing, it seems like, even, than the other 9, because he returned. Okay, well, like I said, we're thankful to be here this morning, or this week, and we're looking forward to our time. Also with some tremblings, like I said. Few things here just opening up that we want to consider. You said 10:45, Mark? Okay. Just a question I want to open up with, and I'd like some of your thoughts to think about this. But why should we study church history? What are some reasons that we could give for studying church history? Why should we look at it? Yes, Brother Levi.
Learn from mistakes.
Learn from mistakes. That's good. That's good. Yes, Brother Goby. That's good. It usually repeats itself. Yes. So any thoughts over here? Yes. To learn where we came from. That's a good one. That's right. To learn where we came from. And yes, Brother Mark. Yes. That's good. That's very good. That's good. That's a good reason. Yes, Brother. That's right. What we're facing isn't that new. That's right. That's right. Nothing new under the sun. Yes, Brother Leonard? That's right. Yeah, one of the big reasons we should study, those are all good. Another reason is to know where we're going. We can see where we're going by studying church history. We can also see where we're at. We can see where we came from, as someone mentioned. We can see where we're at in relation to different situations and influences. And we can identify wrong ideas, doctrines, lifestyle choices, patterns, directions. And we can repent from those in our own lives and turn away from them, realizing that those will not turn out right. If we go down that path, it ends up over here. Someone has said that insanity is to keep making the same mistakes and expect different results. Or we could say insanity is to go down the same path that others did and expect to arrive at a different place. That's insanity. We can't go down the same path that others have and arrive at a different place. The other thing I have down here is simply to learn. We can learn a lot. One life is too short to learn all that I want to learn and all that I need to learn. One life is simply too short for that. as Brother Mark shared, we can see what worked and what didn't work. And then I have here, I get a tremendous challenge out of studying church history. I'm challenged by the devotion and faithfulness of others, and to be motivated in my own pursuit of God and for His kingdom. You know, we're going to be talking, and I want to do this very carefully and tremblingly. I'm not sure how to do it sometimes, but we'll talk about people in this week that their devotion and zeal and sold out commitment for the kingdom of God is outstanding. And I don't want to take away from that in their lives at all. Some of them have, many of them will have accomplished way more than I probably will in my life. But at the same time, I think it's good for our benefit to also observe and try to point out maybe some of the things that they took into their lives or that they were practicing or teaching that had a fruit. There were seeds that turned into fruits that were not good and not positive in their lives and in the lives of their people. So those are some of the things. Let's turn to Job chapter 8. The book of Job chapter 8. And this morning, just have a lot of some introduction here and also some history, kind of laying a foundation of where we want to go the next 4 days. So I also, I was going to mention here, we'll do that. But really would like to have your input here this week. I would welcome that. Any questions you have, any comments. In the middle of my time of sharing, just raise your hand. If something's not clear to you or you like a little more clarification on something, because I'm just picking out some things. There's a lot more that we could share on some of these things. I'm trying to pick out some things to get it to flow. But if you have questions or you'd like to have some discussion on something, just raise your hand. That would bless me. And ask for clarification or ask a question or make a comment. We want to hear from you all. Okay, Job chapter 8, verse 8. Here's Bildad speaking. Bildad, the Shuhite, he's saying here, verse 8, "For inquire, I pray thee, of the former age, and prepare thyself to search of their fathers. For we are but of yesterday, and know nothing, because our days upon earth are a shadow. Shall not they teach thee?" He's saying here, to learn and to inquire of the former age, shall not they teach thee and tell thee and utter words out of their heart? So there we have the book of Job. We have Bildad there encouraging Job to inquire of the fathers and in search of the of former age, and that we can learn. Shall not they teach thee and tell thee and utter words out of their heart? So there's a little bit of a foundation. Now, when Brother Mark called me, talk a little bit here about my assignment this week, and mentioned recent church history, he mentioned that you were wanting to look at some of the influences that led some of the Anabaptist conservative churches from a clear place of separation and nonconformity and non-resistance, and other clear biblical positions. What were some of the influences that took some of these people who were a separated people and help them to integrate and get lost into mainstream Christianity in the past 100 to 150 years? So that's what we were considering in our assignment here. I'm going to be using the words apostasy. Some, and that's a pretty strong word. So I want to be careful in that word. I don't want to beat people up with it. But what were some of the influences? There's no way we can even mention all of them on the one particular group that we're going to focus in on this week. And what were some of the influences that took them from a separated people and helped them to blend and to mesh into the American culture, society, in mainstream American Christianity. apostasy, when I use that word, I just wanted to give a definition so we're on the same page when I use it. An apostasy means an abandonment of what one has professed. So you profess this at one time, and then you abandon that. It means a total desertion from one's faith or religion. And so that's a little stronger. In the things we look at, I don't want to be just condemning and judgmental and critical this week, but I do believe as we go along that that is what happened, and I'm not opposed to calling it apostasy. My burden is to look at this subject truthfully as I can and as clearly as I can see. Now, my vision might not be as clear as yours, but as clearly as I can see, and where we feel there were wrong influences, to be very honest and clear about those, and yet to do the whole thing in a spirit of humility and graciousness. That's how I would want people to look at my past and talk about my mistakes, because I'm sure they could. But I think I would want them to learn from them. I want to learn from my mistakes, and I think I would want others to. And so I think we can do that, but we want to do it in humility and graciousness, realizing that our story hasn't been written yet. It is being written, and it's being recorded. And that's, and someday the record will be read. That's sobering, isn't it? And a great cloud of witnesses, and they'll read our story and our record. And then we'll find out how we really were. Then we shall know as we are known, the Bible says, I think, or the song says that anyway. People that write history tend to influence it with some of their own bias. You can't help that. It's not like writing a chronology or a family tree book where it's just facts. There, you can't help writing it without some bias. For instance, if someone was pro, let's say there's two biographies. I'll just use this example. There's two biographies that I know of written about John S. Kaufman, and we'll mention him quite a bit here this week, probably tomorrow especially. And one of them was written by his granddaughter, I think it is. Is it his daughter? I'm not sure. And the other one was written by one of his friends, a fellow evangelist, M.S. Steiner, named for Menno Simon Steiner, who was a contemporary of his age, a little younger than John S. was, and who looked up to him. Now, those both give a little bit of a different twist to his life, because one of them was his direct descendant. The other one was his friend. He does him pretty well, too. And he's not critical, but he, just between those two writing about his life, you get a little bit of a different perspective on some of the things that were in his life that he faced. And so that's part of how history is written. So if you would take someone who was opposed, let's say an old order, which there are some that have commented on John S. Kaufman's life, let's say an old order Mennonite would write his biography, it would come out quite a bit different. It wouldn't be near as positive as those who were part of his own church affiliation and were his friends and his relatives, that as when they wrote it, it would come out a little different. You see what I'm saying? All right. So I don't want to beat the horse to death here, but you see my point. Now, when we read history, we can easily do the same. It's easy for us to do the same. If Mark or Leonard or Levi or some of the brothers here, if they read the same books I've been looking at the last couple of months, I'm sure that each of us would highlight or emphasize some different points probably, and we would probably have a little different way of presenting it. So just bear with me there. I'm not the final authority on this subject. Actually, as you'll see here in a little bit, I'm a pretty new scholar in this field. Okay, there are a number of different church groups or movements that we could have chosen to look at this week that would run, one of them that runs very parallel. We're going to be talking about what's called the Old Mennonite Church or the Old Mennonite Conference. And old is usually in parentheses. I'm not sure why. Maybe some of the brothers can help me. Because it's not old order, but it's called the Old Mennonite Church. One group that runs very parallel to them actually was a little bit ahead of them in being enculturated. I don't know if that's the right word or is a word, but we'll make it one. Who was being enculturated into American society. They were slightly ahead of the Old Mennonite Church, and that was the Church of the Brethren. Actually, someone had suggested, well, you could do the Church of the Brethren. I haven't collected near as many books on them. I've read a little bit. They want to continue that study, but their story runs very parallel. And we could have looked at them. There's others. There's plenty of other groups. The River Brethren. The River Brethren are a very fascinating story to me. And sometimes some of you need to study that story, the River Brethren. It's an old movement, an old group that is part from Mennonite background and is part from Brethren background. And they merge together somewhat. And they have quite a fascinating story. Donnie Breckbill, he's a River Brethren. And then John Byers, we've asked him to come this February for our men's conference. I really appreciate those brothers. I was at their congregation this past New Year's a year ago and had church with them. They actually asked me to preach for them. It was a blessing. I enjoyed being with them very much. But their story goes back to the late 1700s, I think, it started. And they have maintained, they haven't grown a lot, but they've maintained a tremendous testimony of separation and at the same time spiritual vitality. And I would say that one of the reasons after being at their service is some of the way that they their worship, Sunday morning service, is held. This is one characteristic that's unique to them. They have an hour, 45 minute to an hour testimony time every Sunday morning. So you come to church, you're going to have a 45 minute to an hour. You can request a hymn, and you're not just asked to, you're not just expected to come with something, but you're expected to seek the Lord, everyone. And if there's something on your heart, if there's a challenge, a failure, needs or struggles as well, or just a testimony, you can request a hymn or just stand up, and they have that for 45 minutes every Sunday. So that was a blessing. But yeah, yes, Brother Leonard. Yes, it's both sides. Yes. So I think they probably have to watch that. Nothing against the sisters, but there were a few that got up that morning and they wouldn't preach. It was a testimony. But they requested a hymn, the one, and she actually confessed a need in her life, the one. I remember she cried there and requested prayer, and it was just an open time. So that was one thing. But so that'd be an interesting study. Now they haven't grown in numbers, like I said, as much, but they have done pretty well with that testimony. The other thing is they actually have a number of their people that are fairly educated, some of the college degrees and things, I think. But they've watched over it closely, and somehow they've been able to wade through some of that. Now, maybe I'm painting too favorable of a picture there. I don't know, but I haven't looked into it that far. You can ask Brother John. I'm getting him in trouble here. You'll be asking him questions in February if you're coming up. Okay, I chose to look at the Mennonites. Why did I choose to look at the Mennonites? Actually, just one branch here. It's called the Old Mennonite Church. That's the one we want to look at. It is of a Swiss-German origin. That is their origin. The Mennonites have several. They have the Dutch origin, the Dutch Mennonites, and then you have the Swiss-German, Southern German Mennonites. And I chose it. One of the reasons was that I think there's a number of you here that have Mennonite background. How many of you here have a Mennonite background? Okay, so quite a few of you. How many of you have a Dutch Mennonite background? I think you actually have both, Leonard. Yeah, you have Swiss German on one side and Dutch on the other. That's fascinating. So there's a lot of Swiss German Mennonite background represented here. So that's one reason I chose that. It's also one reason I'm trembling, okay? All right, how many of us here have an Amish background? Maybe you included that with the Swiss Mennonite. You could also, but they were tied in with the Swiss Mennonite. A lot of times they're tied together. So not as many of us. Okay, I have an Amish background that might affect and influence some of the way I see some of these things or share them. I'm not sure. And a lot of us can tend to think that the Old Order Amish and the Old Order Mennonites are pretty much the same. There's actually quite some distinctions and differences. I'm not going to tell you which one's better, but I'll tell you which one there's more of. I can tell you that. But yeah, and those of you who don't have a quote Mennonite background, I want to say, my wife is not from a Mennonite background. Her dad was played in the rock band in the 70s and 80s and was a hippie, part of the hippie movement. So we're blessed that you're with us and that we're all together. Thank you for your contribution to our churches and our lives. So I just asked those statistics because I know there's quite a few of you here that have a Mennonite background. Now, so that is your background. And I again want to welcome your input and your questions, please. And if I share something that that isn't quite in line or is distorted a little, help me with that. Because I'm here to learn as well as to share. Write me a note if you have a question or you'd like to have more discussion on a subject or a topic and you don't want to approach me directly. Just write me a note and ask for something clarified or a question. I'd be glad to try to. My desire is to be here to serve you. And I've been cramming. My desire is to just share what I've learned. So feel free to try to draw it out. Okay. My interest in Mennonite history, my little recent journey, it's a pretty recent journey. I'm a new scholar. I don't want to say scholar. This is a new, let's not put that in there. I'm not sure why I put it in my notes. But, okay, this is new to me, in other words. Approximately 8 or 9 years ago, I've always enjoyed reading. And I was born again in 2001. And I always enjoyed reading. Actually, one of the influences in my life that brought me to Christ was Anabaptist history. And I enjoyed reading. So about approximately 8, 9 years ago, a friend of mine stopped in and looked around my study. Had a lot of books in there. And he said, "Where's your Anabaptist books?" And I had to confess I didn't have very many, really. I had been reading a lot, and I collected books. But there was a lot of good, solid, what I would call old evangelical books that I found a lot of help for in my own personal life, with my personal relationship and walk with Christ, would probably encourage more of a pietistic way of looking at things. But I had a lot of those, you know, and those aren't necessarily bad books. Andrew Murray, A.W. Tozer, Leonard Ravenhill, those old evangelicals, and really can know how to light a fire and challenge you. And I looked around, and I didn't have very many. It challenged me. He didn't challenge me on it other than just asking me the question. And we had maybe some more discussion on it. But I just kind of went like, ooh, yeah, that's a good idea. So I started buying more, and I went into a pretty kind of a heavy diet of Anabaptist history, Anabaptist writings, early church writings. And I'll just say it's been a really exciting and inspiring journey for me, really. I just started on it, and I'm excited about it, looking forward to it. The one thing that I'll say just briefly, one little thing that stood out to me pretty quickly on was some of those old evangelicals knew how to challenge me in my walk with God individually, but they didn't have anything to say about brotherhood, about a church, a brotherhood coming together in unity, in a oneness, in a corporate expression of the life of God and the love of God and the grace of God in prospective communities. They kind of missed it. And the church tended to be made up of a bunch of individuals where the Anabaptist perspective brings that together and sees the church as a beautiful brotherhood and a part of our sanctification process, even where we are sanctified as in growing spiritually by our inner relationships. They purify us and they help us grow. And also think of the power. When you have one individual and one individual living for Christ, that's powerful. But when you have a group of families that are united in one accord and one heart and one vision and one focus and one purpose, united together, can you think of the power and the glory of that? That's exciting to me. Anyway, so that was 8 or 9 years ago. In 2013, we were in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, a few of us. And while we were there, Joshua Robertson took us around the city there. And he was living in the city involved in a school they had. And he was a principal there. And it was a beautiful work that they did there and are doing in a lot of ways. But that they started there in Winnipeg, working mostly among African refugee immigrants. Would that be a way of saying it? Anyway, he took us around Winnipeg and he said, we were asking him questions. And he knew the city well. He knows people. He studied it. And he was telling us, there's about, I think the total population of Winnipeg in 2013, I think it was under a million, just a little bit, I think. It'd say 800,000 or 900,000. And he said, I think there's about 100,000 Aboriginals here that would be native, Canadians, Indians that moved down to the city, 100,000 of those people. He said, I think there's about 60 to 80,000 Filipinos here, and 30 or 40,000 of the Sikh religion. Is that how you say it, Sikh? And it's the highest density, I think, of anywhere in North America there. And then he talked about 100, 150,000 African refugee immigrants. So that was, he was telling about these different people groups, and he told us that, okay, over here on the other side of the Red River, I'm pretty sure he said it's at least 60. Maybe it was 50 to 60. I was thinking he said between 60 and 80,000 Mennonites. And my ears went up, and that was about 5 years ago. And so I had been collecting some Anabaptist books, and I knew that where there's Mennonites, there's usually used bookstores that I can, I enjoy browsing around in. Anyway, we talked about it, and he said, I asked him more questions, and we went over there to a used Mennonite bookstore, and I don't remember if I bought any books or not, but anyway, from the questions I asked, in just my observation, even being at this used Mennonite bookstore, there were Mennonites in there, I was looking around and I was asking him questions, and he said, yeah, he said, these young people, and these are things I saw. I saw young people with tattoos and rings, nose rings, earrings in different parts of their body. I saw some with cut off pants, of course, very immodest, green hair. The hair's different colors. And I said, are those Mennonite young people? He said, yeah, they're Mennonite young people. You talk to them, they'll be pretty proud of the fact that they're Mennonite. And they have some distinctives in their doctrine that they're still adhering to that they actually think they are the true Mennonites. Because they say, we cut off the peripherals and we took the real core of what Mel Simons taught, and we are living that out. That's some of the mentality of the liberal Mennonites. And I was shocked. And I said, how many of these are here? And he's 60,000. And I thought, wow. So we had some other things on that trip, but that left a tremendous impression on me. Because I knew that was just one area, and I had never came, some of you have probably been more exposed to that than I have, but that's the first time I really came face to face. And then I realized 60,000 people. How did this happen? How did 60,000 people, in my opinion, fall off the cliff and went over the edge into apostasy? How did it happen? I just remember, I thought and I thought and I thought about that all the way home, and for weeks after that, that just really captivated my attention. And so then I started buying books on Mennonite history, and I started collecting them. And I started thinking, there has to be, how did those people, three or four generations ago, how did they go from separation to that in three generations? And I started thinking, there has to be an amazing story here for me to learn. I could learn something about how that happened. So I started collecting those books. I hadn't gotten real far down the journey of reading those when I got this call to study. So I'm thankful for the assignment. I don't feel, like I said, it's 5 years ago and I haven't read that much, but I did start. I started asking questions to other people. To give you a little point of reference, when we're talking about the old Mennonite church, that would be Dale Heisey's background. It would also be Chester Weaver's background. I don't know if any of you here were part of the old Mennonite church or not at one time, but that was their background back in the, they were part of the old Mennonite church back in the 60s, 70s, and they both joined Eastern Pennsylvania Mennonite Conference for a time, and then over after a period of time left that. How could a whole people make that transition? Where were the watchmen? What happened? So here I have, and this projector thing is pretty new to me, so you bear with me. I want to try to, just to help you with some pictures. The brothers here thought that could be a blessing. I don't want it to be a distraction at all. But as we go along, it might help you with some points of reference. I just have a few this morning to look at. And this first one must have been taken. It's Jacob Hostetler. Must have been him and his wife. Must have been taken sometime in early. You see that? Okay. Okay. It must have been taken sometime in the mid 1800s, probably. So that was gives you a point of reference. There's a young man, a young Mennonite man in the 1850s. And then we have that, and then we go to this, the 1990s, into peaceful protesting. That's 1969. That's actually pretty early. But that's a group in Washington, D.C. with a peace march, a peaceful protest. So, and then you have some children. So how did that happen? How did that transition? How did we go from that to that? 1850 to 1969, that's not really that long if you stop and think about it. Just a little bit over 100 years. So what happened? What changed and what happened? Also, other questions that came to me, what will keep my descendants from ending up at the same place? And like I said previously, if I go down the same path, they'll end up at the same place. Now, we can't nearly cover all the details, but we want to try to look at some of the influences that I feel were undermining and were directional influences that affected these Mennonite people and took them down the road that they went. Okay, we're just going to give a brief history here of the Mennonites coming to America. Just going to build a foundation this morning, try to get ready for the next four sessions and focus on some more. I want to try to make it practical as we go along. I'm not always the best at that, so you feel free to ask practical questions or make some observations yourself. The Mennonites in Swiss southern Germany, were still being persecuted. There was a sense of persecution from 1660s or in the mid 1600s. Yet there was still, and that kind of waxed and waned at different times, but there was still persecution there. If you never read the book, The Bernese Anabaptist, I'll give you plenty of titles this week if you want them. The Bernese Anabaptist gives you, I think it's called Bernese Anabaptist, gives you the story of we have the Mennonites that came to America, but the Bernese Anabaptist kind of gives you a little more of the story of what happened in the 1600s and 1700s in the Bern canton of Bern, Switzerland. Those that stayed there and some of the things they faced. You could read that sometime. But in 1663 or 1664, there was a Cornelius Plockhoy, and about 25 Mennonite families. This record's a little scattered. They thought about it was his family and maybe 41 other people. So that doesn't sound like 25 families, but those are the statistics. They arrived in the New World here and established a colony at what is now the town of Lewes by the Delaware River along the coast. And that little colony or that little settlement, I don't think it even lasted a year or didn't last very long. And it was totally annihilated. And it was, there's different theories on exactly what happened. But something happened. They were attacked either by the Indians or by the British or something, and the settlement was plundered and destroyed, and it basically disappeared. There were some evidences that they were there, and they had bought the land from some people in Holland, I think, the government or something, but that disappeared. So that would have kind of been the first settlement in America of Mennonites. There is some record of a few business Mennonites, probably would have been Dutch, that were in New York City maybe about that time or a little before or a little after. But it was in 1683 that there's a clear record of a more substantial number of families, at least four or five, six families that came to America and settled at Germantown, Pennsylvania. And this is listed and named as the first ongoing settlement in the New World in Germantown. That also became the first Mennonite conference in America, and that is the Franconia Conference. Even to this day, it's the Franconia Conference. That's the first Mennonite conference. Now, Lancaster Conference was settled and established very soon after Franconia, within a few years. there. So that's when they started. There's a lot we could talk about. That was in 1683. I'll give you one story here. When they came and after they got started, they were very closely connected to the Quakers. And they shared a meeting house. They actually shared services with the Quakers for a number of years. And I'm sure that had ended up influencing and impacting them into more pietistic, you know, leanings or views. But they had that. They met with the Quakers and they actually did not have communion or baptism from 1683 to 1708 because they didn't have a bishop. There was a minister or two here, and they had sounded like they would meet with the Quakers a lot in some interaction, but that's almost 25 years, I think it was. They were concerned about that. Early in the 1700s, they wrote to Germany asking them to send a bishop over so he could have an ordination, and they said no. And then they wrote to Holland asking them to send a bishop for the Dutch Mennonites, and they said no as well, but they gave them some direction and encouraged them to go ahead and ordain one of the ministers as a bishop. So they were able then, they moved ahead there. 1708, they had communion and also built their first Mennonite meeting house. That was, I think, somewhat distinct or separate from the Quakers, and that's where the first settlement took off there, 1708. There's just a lot we could talk about in the 1700s. The Mennonites continued to immigrate and expand through the 1700s. It was just tremendous expansion. It's hard to imagine. We'll talk a little bit about this tomorrow, but they just pushed and pushed out, and many times to their own detriment of their own spirituality because of land opportunities. They kept moving west, and they would move with just a couple families because they had opportunities, and there was no church there. And there's thousands of Mennonite people got acclimated or just lost into American society and culture because of the expansion. And they would move out here in a few families and there wouldn't be a church there or a minister. And they would go to the Methodists or other church groups and eventually they lost their. And we could look at that. We could learn something from that. I think there's a spiritual, they were willing to try to better themselves. With land and it wasn't all bad. I think they were wanting land. They wanted land because they wanted to raise families on the farm, and they wanted to be able then to have a farm big enough for their children, their sons especially, to have farms close by them. And as Lancaster County and those other early counties got more populated, land prices went up, and they just kept expanding. But many Mennonites got lost in the middle of that shuffle. There was a renewal movement that came through in the 1700s. They had strong influence from the Brethren people who were more pietistic and more evangelistic and reaching out to them, a little more life and vitality in their profession of Christianity, and they got quite a few Mennonite people. Martin Boehm there in the First Great Awakening in the 1700s. That affected them too, and there was some renewal movements there where different groups broke off into wanting more spiritual life and vitality and vibrancy and revival, and they broke off from the Mennonite churches. Usually, those people that broke off, and this is something we need to learn from, usually they only lasted a couple generations, and they ended up just being back into regular American Christianity many times. Now, we're going to talk about the situation in the Mennonite church and try to take an honest view at it. And so, it's not like everything was well there either, at all. But you had the American Revolution War, the Revolutionary War there in the 1700s, that brought challenge to them. Some of them tried to keep loyalty to the King of England. Some of them were more sympathetic with the colonists, and they got in trouble on both sides there somewhat, created some challenges. But we don't have time to reflect on all that. I'm just trying to bring you down here. So we're going to, looking at the old Mennonite church, we want to start, we're going to go to about the mid-1800s. The mid-1800s here, I don't know if, let's see, I just have a little chart. Let's see if it'll come up here. Yeah. So there's some difference too on these dates. I don't know what to do with all that, but there's some differences. But this, the old Mennonite church developed into 13. I think there's 11 listed here, maybe, but 13 conferences, more regional conferences. Like I said, the first one was Franconia, and then you had Lancaster. In the book Keeping the Trust, the story of the Eastern Pennsylvania Mennonite Conference, he lists that Franconia's conference actually, they actually started in 1708 and Lancaster started in 1711. So I don't know the difference, why there's difference there. But this is what it looked like going into the mid to late 1800s. Indiana, that turned into Indiana-Michigan Conference there. And I think there was some more Western conferences that developed even later. But that's kind of what it looked like. So that's what the old Mennonite church we want to be talking about. Those were their regional conferences. We want to look at, sometime this week, we want to look at how they came together in 1898 to form what's called their general conference, or their church-wide conference. The Lancaster, Franconia, and Virginia, they were the older ones, the older conferences. They did not join in with their church-wide conference in 1898. They stayed aloof from that a little bit. They were the three most conservative. Franconia, Lancaster, and Virginia were the conservative ones were in the east. More established communities. The ones in the west tended to be more recent immigrants and also people that expanded out from the east, and they were less conservative. And they always had this trouble of those Western churches influencing the East, and they were ahead of them in progression. It's just a few things there, but that's who we're talking about this week. We're going to look at before 1898, when most of these conferences organized as a general conference. I mentioned that the old Mennonites did not have formal church-wide structures. But the various bishops tried to keep themselves informed of the proceedings and decisions of the other district conferences. Often they attended each other's conferences, and they had some connection that way. Now, why did I choose this? Why did I choose the old Mennonite church? The old Mennonite church. Why did I choose to talk about them? Well, this is why. Because they seemed to be the middle course. If you study it, you'll find out that these were kind of looked at as being the middle course between what was the general conference. We'll talk about its origin here today. You had them as the most progressive, and then on the most conservative side, you had the old order branches that broke off, and we'll talk about them. And then in the middle of that, you had the old Mennonite church. And they were kind of considered to be in the middle between the two. And I thought that'd be interesting. Let's look at where they went and some of the decisions they made. The old Mennonite church seemed to stand at the center of a well-defined ladder of acculturation. They were kind of in the middle. If you wanted to be more progressive, you left and went to the general conference. If you wanted more conservative, you went to the old orders. On the more progressive side, we should look at the beginnings of that, because we'll maybe reference it different times throughout this week. On the more progressive side, we have what happened. This was on October 7th in 1847, 16 ministers and bishops attending the regular fall session of the Franconia Mennonite Conference in Pennsylvania. They were attending the regular fall session. 16 ministers and bishops walked out of the meeting and soon started the East Pennsylvania Mennonite Conference. They wanted a faith that seems less formal, and they hoped to instill a deeper piety, individual piety, in their people. This reform movement was led by John Oberholzer. John Oberholzer, I got a picture of him here. He led that reform movement. It started in 1847. Now, there's no question, to his defense, that the old Mennonite church needed some reform. And I would welcome some of you older brothers, if you have stories you've heard or whatever. But the one thing they had that they were facing in the mid-1800s is they had alcohol. They even had people that were distilling it and had their own breweries and among them. It was a low spiritual time. in the old Mennonite church. It was a very low spiritual time. It was the youth were not joining the church. The youth were, it was not expected almost even that they join the church until after they're married. Like I heard about one meeting, I read about or heard about it. This was maybe later in the 1800s. This went on for some time with the young people. But in the late 1800s, the ministry met. I think they met before the service. Do they still do that in the old order churches? Did they meet before the service? Yeah, okay, that's what happened. And a young man came, wasn't married, came in and met with the ministry. And he mentioned that he wanted to be part of the church. He wanted to be baptized. After he left, one of the ministers said, "Yeah, that's good, but I wish he'd have waited until after he was married." It's just, I don't know why they developed or how they developed that mindset. Another issue they had was tobacco. They were growing it and they were using it. I heard or even read of some things where there were spittoons by the pulpit. Is that, am I too far out there or not? But yes, okay, he's saying yes back there. Yeah, so I mean, you think of that. You see, there was a low, it was a low spiritual time for the Mennonite church. The old Mennonite church there. There were other things. If you have, do you have anything else? Any of you want to mention on that? That was, we'll talk a little more about that tomorrow too, because we want to talk about revivalism. Yes, go ahead, brother. Maybe he's muted.
Anyway, I might be able to speak loud enough. It's just thinking about here at Natural Time. It's a story from...
And carry this into tomorrow, because we're going to pick it up. Go ahead.
And this is, yeah, just the idea. There's this one Amishman was here in America, and they were quite affected by the culture. And so he said, well...
He shot what? He shot an Indian. Right. I see.
And so it's just an example of
wow.
The strong philosophy that
yes.
Around them, they kind of embraced it and
yes.
Got absorbed in that, some of them.
Thank you. They lost their, separate some of their moorings there. Okay, so those are some of the things they were facing. So there's, we would all say they needed reform. So I can't just criticize him, but let's look here a little bit at some of the things he wrote in the spirit of which he wrote them, and maybe we'll, can learn something. Thank you. 1847, they left. They left Franconia Conference. In 1860, they grouped with, formally grouped with some of the like-minded people across the United States and Canada, and they created the General Conference, Mennonites. General Conference, Mennonites. So, GC, a lot of my books just refer to it as GC. That's General Conference. And we'll refer to that. If I talk about General Conference, it'll be here. The Old Mennonites also formed in what was a General Conference, but it always was the Old Mennonite Church Conference. It was a little difference. Yes, brother. The General Conference that he started, the General Conference that Oberholzer helped to start, they came out of Franconia. The Franconia and Mennonites, or the Lancaster would have been part of the Old Mennonite Church. And he officially left the Old Mennonite Church. And we're looking at this as the progressive wing that would have been more on the liberal side of the Old Mennonite Church. But he left. Is there any other? Yeah, feel free. I appreciate the questions for clarity. Oberholzer, this man, in a letter to his friends in Germany in 1849, these are some of the reasons he gives that he left. Oberholzer lamented that the American Mennonites were in a low state of ignorance. Quote, he was glad to say that his group had some of the most skillful speakers. Thank God. In the old church, he said, 4 of 5 preachers were failures in the pulpit. Yes, the first consideration for a minister was a blameless walk, but congregations should also choose men who could speak in a clear, distinct voice and with natural fluency. So when his criticism, that's some of it. I'll give you another, some of the things here as well. That was one of the issues that he was struggling with. Oberholzer strongly agreed with Hawk and Daniel Brenneman. We'll talk about Daniel Brenneman tomorrow, Lord willing, and other revivalists about some of the old church's shortcomings, slow-tongued ministers and dull sermons, rigid, reactionary, and arbitrary authority, fixation with clothing and external trivia, and need for deeper and more inward piety. He agreed also that Mennonites were too separatist and slow to fellowship with other pious Christians. So those are some of the reasons he gave. In his criticism, he should have maybe he should have remembered the importance of humility in a minister's life, I think, too. So Overholser chose a slightly, in his people, they chose a slightly different model than the old Mennonite church. A progressivism expressed in missions, higher education, and other activism. Overholser and those with him spent much of their energy negatively reacting against what they considered formalism, legalism, and outmoded ways of the old church. My, does that sound familiar? Lord help us. But that's what they did. It's so easy to do, and it's natural to do, I imagine. You see, they were struggling. I'm not denying the old church was failing in some areas and struggling. I read this morning here in Psalms some verses that really challenged me and blessed me. Let thy lying lips be put to silence, which speak grievous things proudly and contemptuously against the righteous. I just say, wow. And I think of speaking this week on people that in church history, I need to be careful with my attitude. I need to be careful what I say. There's no blessing on that. Another one here. O love the Lord, all ye his saints, for the Lord preserveth the faithful and plentifully rewardeth the proud doer. So the Lord plentifully rewardeth the proud doer. And those aren't the kind of rewards we want. So over the next decade, the like-minded Mennonites elsewhere in the U.S. joined with Overholser and his people to form in 1860 what became the General Conference Mennonites in America. And we'll just be referring to it as General Conference. And that's who we mean when we refer to that. They were a little bit more on their history. The old Mennonite church was by statistics and more distinctly a Swiss Southern German culture and Mennonite people. The General Conference had their origin out of the old Mennonite church, but they thrived and took off predominantly when the Prussian Mennonites immigrated to America in the 1870s, a lot of those people became General Conference. And then also in Canada. Yes, Kobe. They all stayed as a conference. Franconia stayed, but 16 of their ministers left and divided Franconia Conference. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, the ones that there were Mennonites that immigrated later in like the 1870s, and they were the ones that came from Dutch and then went to Prussia and then went to Russia, and then they immigrated. And when they came, there was some cultural difference between them. In even the way that the old Mennonite church, which was Swiss German, the way they function with their church authority and things, that they didn't mesh as well. They tended to gravitate more to the General Conference, and they worked in harmony. The other thing was the General Conference had an ecumenical push from the beginning. They wanted to unite all the other Mennonite groups they could. They had a heart to do that and work together. It wasn't all bad, I wouldn't say. But the General Conference that started there in 1860, they went much further in accepting two American patterns, denominationalism and progressivism. They chose to be more in the world culturally, which means they lost their nonconformity sooner. That's what it simply means. They were, you can see what he was saying. We think we should have more fellowship with people that are that are not as distinct and don't hold our distinctive doctrines. We should have more interaction and fellowship. And we know what happens with that. Probably not as fast as it does today, but that is the direction they move. Their slogan for their conference was unity in the essentials, liberty in non-essentials, and love in all things. Today, they support gay marriage and even might ordain them. So General Conference was on the progressive side. Now, let me give you the irony of the situation. They were always working to unite all the different Mennonite groups into an ecumenical working together. Side note here, as the old Mennonite church developed, also promoting, as we'll look at, revivalism later in the 1800s, higher education, and these aren't necessarily bad things, just because I'm saying, and we'll try to work through it. But they promoted higher education, revivalism, in different acculturation as well. They actually started working back with the General Conference on the MCC, the Mennonite Central Committee, and different peace movements of and outreach efforts. They worked back with them, and they tried by 1950 and on. There were people on both sides trying to bring them back together. And brother, could you bring me that chart right there on the table? I forgot to look it up. But by, I think it was late 1900s, they brought the General Conference and the old Mennonite Church back together and formed what is called Mennonite USA. So they did bring it back together after the other one finally, in 2002 it says they merged. 2002, those two groups came back together to form Mennonite USA. Now, recently, the church at Bern, First Mennonite Church at Bern on the corner there by the clock tower of the big church, that was always a General Conference church. Its whole existence, ever since it was started in the mid-1800s, that was not an old Mennonite church that was part of the conference, other conferences. That was a General Conference Mennonite church. They all came together in 2002 to form Mennonite USA. Now, in the last couple years, Lancaster Conference, which was the most conservative of those I listed, it's always been the most conservative, they pulled back out. Maybe Washington County, Maryland, maybe they're more conservative. But Lancaster Conference pulled back out of Mennonite USA over this gay lesbian situation. And the First Mennonite Church of Bern left also and joined Lancaster Conference. I don't know if you can follow all that. That might be too much, but that, it is amazing over that issue. So they actually finally said, we can't go there. They finally drew a line way too late, but they drew a line. And sure, unity in essentials, liberty in non-essentials, and love in all things. And of course, dress was not an essential. Or nonconformity wasn't made an essential, really. But they found out, they had their eyes open. They didn't just go and go like some of the other revival movements. I'll say this for General Conference. They kept a measure of separation, at least in some of the things. They wouldn't have been able to get back with the old Mennonite church when they did. But what it really shows is that the old Mennonite church, that's where they ended up. It took them longer to get there, but that's where they ended up. And that's our story. Okay, I'll give you a few statistics. At the end of around 1890, just to give you some bearing, General Conference was more progressive, like I said, his people that he helped start. By 1890, they had 44 congregations and 5,231 members. That was in 1890. Okay. Now, I said that Old Mennonite Church, what we're looking at this week, was more in the middle, took a middle road between progressivism in the old orders. Now we want to take a look at the old orders a little bit to establish our bearings. And here, please share any questions or thoughts. Help me out with this. The first major, there was a smaller old order division, I think 1845, in Pennsylvania. And those are called, someone tell me what those are called? It's in here. Okay. What was that? Pike, I think that was maybe one of them. It's not the one I was thinking of. They were the Stauffer Mennonites. Stauffer Mennonites. There was a group that broke off a little earlier. But the major, when the people talk about the Old Order Division, as a whole, the historians talk about it, they start in 1872 with the Whistler Division in Indiana. The first major Old Order Division took place in 1872, at the Yellow Creek Congregation, close to Goshen, Indiana. Jacob Whistler was the bishop there, and there were three factions in his congregation. There was a minister, Daniel M. Brenneman, I think it is, and we'll talk a little more about him tomorrow, but he had a strong push for revivalism, kind of a Methodist-type emotionalism. He was considered a strong progressive push. He was there as a minister. Then you had the minister John Funk, and we'll talk more about him tomorrow too. But he was trying to walk in the middle as a cautious progressive who had the support of the old Indiana-Michigan conference. He was the one, the conference was kind of behind John Funk. Daniel Brenneman was a little too charismatic in what he was pushing for. John Funk was more cautious, but he was also wanting to move forward and step with the conference. John Funk wanted Sunday schools, church publication. Obviously, he started the Herald of Truth and also both the English and the German edition of that publication in 1860s. We'll talk about that tomorrow. But he wanted Sunday schools, church publication, and some other changes that the conference was going along with, the Indiana-Michigan conference. Then you had Bishop Jacob Whistler and his supporters who were saying, no Sunday schools, no protracted meetings, revival meetings, no night meetings at all, no four-part harmony singing. They were against Funk's Herald of Truth church publication, and they were somewhat opposed to using English in worship service. Those were some of the things that they were saying they don't want to change. Now, when you have these divisions, you have some of those things that are there, but you almost always have personality and other problems involved as well. But those were kind of the two factions, or the three factions. I'm sure there were other ingredients involved. Is there any comments on that? Does any of you have anything from your studies? Okay. What happened was the Indiana Conference put a committee in place, the way I understand this, and they admonished Bishop Jacob Whistler, and they gave him time to consider. And then John Funk, I think at the time that was given or sometime in there, John Funk didn't wait on the committee to do the discipline. And he went ahead as a 36-year-old minister and excommunicated a 63-year-old bishop. So that's where the break then happened. Then 2 years later, Daniel Brenneman left and went a more progressive way. Yellow Creek as well, Daniel Brenneman did. Those three groups were there. But John Funk was kind of the middle of the road. Remember, we're talking about that here, the old Mennonite church. He was, quote, representing the middle road, but it wasn't very wise of him, I don't think, as a 36-year-old to do that. He should have waited on the conference if there was a need for discipline. Anyway, so that started the old order division. 1872 in Indiana and Ohio. In Ontario, Canada, it was 1889. And then what most of you are probably more familiar with would have been the Pennsylvania Old Order Division that centered around Bishop Jonas Martin in 1893. And out of that division, you had the Groffdale Conference started. Those were the Old Order Mennonites in Pennsylvania. They stayed longer. And again, Lancaster Conference was more conservative. And Lancaster Conference had adopted Sunday schools and things, but there was Bishop Martin and some of them that did not want to go that way. And they eventually then, over with other things to play in there, I'm sure you could probably tell me stories. But then they divided in 1893, and he took a third of his district with him, I think. So it was a fairly substantial division there. It wasn't a third of Lancaster Conference, but it was a third of his district. Yes, brother. It was Weaverland Conference. And then later, when you had the Horning in you had the Weaverland-Groffdale division in 1927, that's right. And that was over the car. They were all considered old orders, but in 1927, the Hornings or the Weaverlands got cars, and then the Groffdale kept the horse and buggy. Is that right? And so that was, they're called T. Mennonites or Groffdale Conference. So that's actually when it started. Thank you for that. See, I told you I need your help. So that was what happened. You had the old orders divided, the Whistlers did in Indiana as well over the vehicle. You had the old order horse and buggy and the old order with the vehicle sometime in the early 1900s. But that's when it happened in Pennsylvania. Then Virginia, they had their old order division in 1900. So this thing started in Indiana, but it went basically clear through the old Mennonite church, the old order division. It took some time to do that. But then you had those three branches that we're talking about. So in 1890, before the Jonas Martin division, which would have added several hundred people, I don't know how many exactly, with the old orders, you had Indiana, Ohio, and Ontario, and that represented just a little bit over 1,000 people. The old order Mennonites would have been 1,000 plus people with the Jonas Martin people, it would have been a little more. I don't know exactly how many. I don't have a statistics. Interesting side note. Three generations after the 1893 schism, Jonas Martin had more descendants in Lancaster Conference, the Old Mennonite Conference. He had more descendants in Lancaster Conference than the seven bishops who expelled him. Three generations later. Yes. Yes. Well, he was, thank you, Bishop Martin, they were able to keep it together until, and he passed away in 1925, and then in 1927, they had the horse and buggy vehicle division. So they didn't have the Horning, the Weaver Lynn Grofdale while he was still alive. It happened after he was passed away. He was, I don't know if he was that influenced. They said that he wouldn't let the ministry have vehicles, but he wouldn't let people that had cars commune, I don't think. So they had the problem there while he was alive, but they didn't divide until after he passed away. Yes. The Old Mennonite Church, those seven bishops probably lost their children, I would say. Three generations would have put it, 1890, would have put it, what, 1960s maybe? Approximately. What is it? And so, yes, go ahead. You have some help there. Yes. We'll see that. Yes. It's not very good. Yeah, it's good. So I think what happened, it's an irony, I guess. I don't know that it was like that everywhere. But those seven bishops, their descendants didn't stay even in the conservative church, even in the Old Mennonite church, which would have been apostatizing. Okay, so Old Mennonite church is kind of a middle road between those two groups. In 1890, the Old Mennonite church, the conferences I had listed up here, I know it's a little confusing, and I'm sorry. I didn't even know those differences 5 years ago when I started reading them. So I don't know what we should do. You tell me if there's something else we should call them. But in 1890, you had the general conference, these people that went more progressive, 5,000 and some people. The old orders, 1,500 people. And the old Mennonite church had 17,000 people. So it was a larger body, too, that it represented. It was quite a bit larger than the other two branches. Now, we could mention John Holderman and the Holderman movement. That started in around 1859, and they actually are a pretty substantial, sizable group today. But they came out also wanting more revivalism, and actually with a push to go back to hold some of Menno Simons' doctrines more practically or more... Yeah. And then you could talk about Henry Egli, who started the Defenseless Mennonite Church there in Bern area. He came out of the Amish, and they eventually, Henry Egli and Daniel Brenneman, and some of those revivalist shoots that broke off in the mid-1800s, joined together to form the missionary churches, there's another name I can't think of it, but they ended up losing there. There's still his church where he's buried, where Henry Egli is buried, is right there west of Bern a little ways. They were strong on missions. They did some powerful things there, but they lost out pretty early on. Those the ones that went the most progressive there. So I kind of have this illustrated, what we've been talking about, in a few pictures here. Here we have the Yellow Creek. That's Yellow Creek, Indiana. That's the Mennonite, that's the Whistler Church. Today, they drive cars, but they would have been part of that Jacob Whistler's branch. They had a division later over cars and horse and buggies. But this is the Whistler Church, Yellow Creek, Mennonite, Whistler. And across this, just down the road, just a little bit, you have Yellow Creek, Horse and Buggy, Mennonite Church. It's called Yellow Creek. And across the road from the Whistler Church, you have they call it Yellow Creek Brick. And this was where John Funk and the old Mennonite church went. This was there. This is those people. So you have all three right on the same corner. Or those two especially. There's no general conference church there, but those two are right there in the corner at Yellow Creek. They're all called Yellow Creek Mennonite. And I'm sure they all say they're the true Mennonite. Anyway, that's sobering. It's not really funny, is it? Okay, any questions or comments? Here, did I get you thoroughly confused? Please clarify it if I... Yes, brother. That's a good, I can't answer that. That's a good question. I don't know if, they probably didn't join Grofdale Conference, did they? Okay. Yeah, separate. Yeah, there's an Old Order Mennonite man that I buy some fish from. I'll have to ask him. He could tell me. I've had some. That is that church. At least some fellowship or interaction probably between them. That's a good question. Yes, Kobe. Oh, yes. Yes. I have a whole book. If you want to, I'll show you the book on there. Hold. I don't. They have maintained. Yes. That's tremendous. That's the. Wow. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. They have it now. Wow. In revivals too? That'd be a tremendous story of, share more as we go along this week. I have the book. I haven't read it. It was one I wanted to read. I'll show it to you. It's the story of the Washington County, Maryland, and Franklin County, Pennsylvania, Mennonites, I think, conference. And it was listed up there with them, but somewhere they must have left. Or Leonard told me they never officially joined the whole old conference. Okay. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yes. You can enjoy a spiritual conversation with, that's exciting. Thank you. I'd like to hear more about it. See, I didn't mind that nugget yet. I'm still looking for it. Yes, Brother Leonard. 1866, I think. But he came out of the Amish church there, I think. That could be. The Egli Amish. Yeah. The Egli Amish, it was kind of a revival movement. I mean, you look at what they wanted. They wanted clear born-again conversions. They wanted missions. And there was a lot of things. Yeah. Amen. And so it was good. But they started a mission in Congo. It's a fascinating story. You need to read it. But, I stopped. Well, Chester and I stopped at the church building, and they have their original church there. Henry Egli's buried out in the cemetery, and the original church is there with inside their big church. And and you wouldn't notice there's nothing conservative. They, in the last 10 years, they used to be something defense. No, it used to be something Mennonite church. But they took that off the sign now. So they should have. John, yes. You say, are you asking if they do?
They do.
Oh, they do? Yes. Sure. That's tremendous. I wonder what size that would be. Maybe it's in my statistics back there. We'll have to look, because that would be interesting. But that's exciting. There's a testimony. I can appreciate that, especially as we see where the rest of the old Mennonite church went. That's outstanding. So they had something there that they were able to keep that and nurture and not lose their way. Yes. Which one? Tobacco was. Were the Washington County supporting it? They were against it. That's interesting. It would be interesting to, I'm sure there's probably some men that had a vision that were part of that, that influenced those people. It usually is. We can't separate men and movements a lot of times. But someone did. That's exciting. Thank you. Okay. The title for my series this week is, I want to call it, The Old Mennonite Church in the Spirit of Progress. The Old Mennonite Church in the Spirit of Progress. My title for the week. And today would just be an introduction in early history, or whatever you want to call it. So I hope we're kind of on the same page. Tomorrow we want to take off with the Old Mennonite Church and go forward from there. So I hope we can be on the same page of who we're talking about. Thank you for bearing with me. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Yes. That was good. Yes. 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 Thank you, Abner. Yes. Yeah, don't. That's very good. Thank you. Yeah, 5 years ago, I wouldn't have known most of anything I told you today. So it's been a journey for me. And, yeah, so I've had to learn. All right. But thank you for that. Yeah, don't space out. All right. I think that's all I have. So, there's a table in the back. I'll put this timeline down there, and I have some statistics I'll lay out there if you're interested. I gave you the statistics around 1890, and you can see where some of that went. You can look at them if you want, and from Edsel Burge. And then later this week, I'll put some books back there that I've used for studying Mennonite history, and you're welcome to look through those. And if you are interested in any of the titles or whatever, you can do that. So God bless you. Thank you. And I appreciate your prayers, your interest.